I had the privilege earlier this week, actually just a couple of days ago on Friday night, to speak at the InterVarsity Campus Fellowship at Christopher Newport University. And one of the things they've been doing for the last semester at InterVarsity at Christopher Newport is they've been going through the book of Ecclesiastes. Now, Ecclesiastes is not a book of the Bible that gets a lot of talk time, a lot of press time, a lot of reading time. So I found that fascinating that they were working through this. And as I did some work on Ecclesiastes chapter 9, I thought it was just the sort of thing that we ought to talk about and have some conversation about as we were together this Sunday morning. Now, before we get into that, let me say that for the next couple of weeks, we've had our time change. We've now fallen back. And Thanksgiving is on the horizon, which means we need to start getting ready for Christmas because the Advent season is coming. So starting next week, we're going to begin in the book of Luke. And we're going to spend the next year or so in the book of Luke, studying Luke together. And Luke begins with the story of John the Baptist. So in order to get us ready for Christmas, in order to get us ready to begin thinking through the Advent journey that we're going to be on, we're going to talk about John the Baptist and some of the things that we need to learn there starting next Sunday. So we'll be with JB next Sunday and enjoy that conversation together. But until we get there, we need to talk about Ecclesiastes 9. And honestly, Ecclesiastes is unlike any other biblical book that's in here. Because frankly, this book is a book of good news. And actually, Ecclesiastes, the preacher who writes Ecclesiastes for generations, it was considered that Solomon wrote Ecclesiastes. Now most scholars think it's just written in the vein of the wisdom of Solomon rather than actually being written by King Solomon. So it's written by a wise teacher, and this wise teacher, this teacher or preacher as he is alternatively known, well, he had some issues. He was not one who was prone to, shall we say, looking on the bright side of life. Look at it with me, Ecclesiastes chapter 9. Let's read this together. So I reflected on all of this and concluded that the righteous and the wise, what they do, are in God's hands. But no man knows whether love or hate awaits him. All share a common destiny, the righteous and the wicked, the good and the bad, the clean and the unclean, those who offer sacrifices and those who do not. As it is with the good man, so it is with the sinner. As it is with he who takes oaths, so with those who are afraid to take them. This is the evil in everything that happens under the sun. The same destiny overtakes all. The hearts of men, moreover, are full of evil, and there is madness in their hearts while they live. And afterward, they join the dead. Anyone who is among the living has hope. Even a live dog is better off than a dead lion. Now, wouldn't that be great on a t-shirt? Even a live dog is better than a dead lion. That's just a great life motto. Somebody needs to make that their life verse. For the living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing. They have no further reward, and even the memory of them is forgotten. Their love, their hate, and their jealousy have long since vanished. Never again will they have a part in anything that happens under the sun. Like I say, this fellow, this writer, is a real downer. You can hear in this chapter, the beginning of chapter 9, his thesis statement, which is all the way back in Ecclesiastes 1. The verses that continue to show up over and over again. Chapter 1, verse 2 and 3, it says, "Meaningless, meaningless," says the teacher. "Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. What does a man gain from all his labor at which he toils under the sun?" Everything is meaningless. Well, that's really uplifting. This guy's a real downer. Now, you may have met this person in your life at some point or another. I don't know. Maybe this person is your neighbor. Maybe you live with this person, bless your soul. But maybe you've come across this person. Can you imagine this person with this attitude of the teacher? Can you imagine if he was your accountant? Just think about that for a second. Here's the great news. You're getting a $1,500 refund, but you better spend it quick, because guess what? You're going to die. Maybe, what would it be like to go out on a date with this guy? You just imagine if you're in the dating scene and you answer, you know, the personal on whatever one of those things are online. You go out to date on a first date with this guy and you say to him at the end of it, you know, I really had a good time tonight. And he says, I did too, but really it doesn't matter because one day you and I were both going to die. I wonder if he'd get a second date. What if this guy was your counselor? What if this guy was your counselor? You're laying on that couch, you're saying, you know, I've been feeling a little bit depressed lately. And he says, well, you should, because you're going to die. Well, this is fantastic. What if this guy was your teenage son? Just imagine if this guy was your teenage son. You come into his room, and you can't even wade through it. There's so much stuff. It's all stacked up. There's clothes, and there's books. There's everything in there. There's clothes that haven't been washed in months. The sheets, gosh, those are the same sheets he had when he was 6 years old. It's all like that, and it's all in there. And you're like, dude, you got to clean something up in here. You got to wash some of this stuff. There's half-eaten pizza over here that's been there for a month. You got to do something with this. You got to wash the sheets at least once before your next birthday. Something's got to give here. And your teenage son just puts his hand on your shoulder and says, Dad, don't worry about it. Whether we're clean or whether we're nasty, we're all going to die. Just imagine. Or maybe you've been working for your company for 25 years or so, and you've just gotten downsized. And this, you've got this friend who's a lot like this teacher. So you go to him, and you pour your heart out to him, and you're talking, and you're teary, and you said, man, I've worked so hard, and I don't understand why this happened this way. And he just puts his arm around you and said, man, that stinks. But it's not all bad. You could be dead. After all, it's better to be alive and miserable than dead and famous. Or as my favorite Bible scholar, the preacher in Ecclesiastes, said, better to be a live dog than a dead lion. Gosh, it'd be hard to be around this guy all the time, wouldn't it? He's charming. I ran across this quote as I was studying Ecclesiastes 9 this week. It says this, Ecclesiastes 9, 1 through 6 are among the saddest words in any literature and the most hopeless. Not merely the saddest in the Bible, the saddest in all of literature. They're just flat out depressing. And friends, we talk about this book. We talk about this as good news. Where is the good news here? What can we learn from this as we throw out these words from this teacher who is obviously in need of some therapy or some kind of medication or something? He's very unhappy. He looks at the whole of the world and he sees the mess and he says, there's no point to any of this. Because whether we're good or whether we're evil, we all end up dead in the same place. Now, for a little cultural understanding, you need to know that in Judaism at the time, they didn't really have a sense of the resurrection of the dead or of an afterlife, so to speak. That was not what was going on with them. That's not what they understood. As a matter of fact, even in Jesus' time, when we get to the New Testament, that's a relatively new occurrence. As a matter of fact, Jesus actually throws a little grenade in between, a verbal grenade in between the Sadducees and the Pharisees at one point, and the Sadducees and the Pharisees start arguing with each other because the Sadducees didn't believe in the resurrection of the dead, and the Pharisees did. So this is a context that we need to understand. For the writer of Ecclesiastes, afterlife is not an assumed thing as it is for us as followers of Jesus. When you follow Jesus, you live now and for all eternity with Jesus Christ. So this is a different understanding and a different life view. How on earth does this writing and this teaching connect with us at all? How does this part of the Word of God have anything to say to us where we are, especially as dreary as it comes across? So a couple of things. First thing I think we need to understand is the teacher in Ecclesiastes teaches us that we need to face our reality. If there's one thing that he's really good at, he's really good at noting how things really are. He notes that in the world there's brokenness, and that brokenness is suffered not just by the people who do bad things. Brokenness and suffering happen to people who do good things. He is very good at noting, the teacher is very good at noting that reality is, it doesn't matter whether you do the right things and follow God with your whole life or whether you never even acknowledge God, you are going to experience some brokenness and some pain in your life. That's the way this works. As a matter of fact, Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount something very similar. He said, the rain falls on the just and on the unjust. In other words, bad stuff can happen to anybody. Bad stuff is not an indicator that you've been a bad person. Bad stuff is an indicator that we live in a culture and a world that is filled with sin, and that sin leads to evil, and that sin permeates all that is, and that's exactly what God sent Jesus to clean up and to make things different. The reality the preacher sees in the world is that evil is overwhelming, and it's hard for him to shake it. But what he points out to us is that we are better off owning what reality is than trying to reshape reality in our own minds so that we don't have to face it. Because many of us spend our whole lives running from reality, trying to craft reality in our own way, trying to tell the story in a way that we want it to be rather than the way that it is. And friends, it takes a whole lot of energy to create a false reality and then believe that false reality rather than facing things as they are. Sadly, I think church people are really good at this. How many times have we come to a church gathering, connected with some of our good friends at church, and it'd been a week where everything went wrong? We got the tax bill the same week the dog had to go to the vet, and it ended up being $8 million or whatever it cost to take a dog to the vet. Your children didn't do what they were supposed to do. Your husband didn't do what he was supposed to do. Your wife didn't do what she was supposed to do. Everything did not turn out well. Work was horrible. Everything was a mess. And on top of that, you had a health test that turned out abnormal, and you're not quite sure what's going on next. And you walk into the door for worship that Sunday morning. One of your good friends comes up to you and says, hey, how are you doing? How was your week? And what do we say most of the time? We say, fine. It wasn't fine. Your life's hanging by a thread at the moment. And some of that is, we don't want to face that. We want to make sure that everybody knows that we're okay. We want to give the impression that everything is together. And somehow we've decided that at church, we have to be people who have everything together and everything looking scrubbed clean and right. And friends, that's just not the way Jesus was. Jesus met people where they were and accepted them and loved them where they were. So somehow we ought to be free to be our real selves. Now, I understand that you may not want to advertise every bit of your reality to every person in this room. I get that. But there ought to be some people where we're real with. Some brothers and sisters in Christ were able to say, I need you to pray because I am down. Maybe I shouldn't be. Maybe I should have a better head on my shoulders. But right now, I'm just broken up. Please pray with me. Pray over me. We need to be willing to not run from the reality about ourselves and the reality about our situation. What if following Jesus was more about trusting God with our deepest questions, rather than attempting to learn all the right answers that sound good or that look good in Bible study but ring hollow when they face the real tribulation of life? What if following Jesus wasn't about looking right? What if it was about being honest about who we really are and about where we're really struggling? I don't know about you, but it's really comforting to be able to just say sometimes, I'm not okay. I'm really hurting. I'm really wrestling and I'm really broken. And I could use someone praying for me and encouraging me this season. What if we were really that honest with each other? What real ministry and care could we do for one another if we gave each other permission to not be okay? The writer of Ecclesiastes, he's really good at being real. Maybe too good. He's really good at noting how broken everything is and how messed up things can get. Maybe we should spend more energy owning things that are broken and things that are messed up about our lives than we do trying to hide it. Now, we move on, and this writer, we notice something else. We notice that he never seems to get out of his depression about the reality. He never seems to get beyond how hard things are. And we need to understand, we need to learn from his mistake here, because we need to learn that even as we own and are honest about what our reality is, we need to understand that we need to look at our reality from God's perspective. We need to look at our reality from God's wider perspective than just the moment. Now, how many of you are familiar with what myopia is? Anyone? Myopia? Okay, good, good. We've got a lot of myopia fans out there. All right, how many of you are nearsighted? Anybody in the room? Nearsighted? Anybody in here wear glasses? Anybody in here have perfect vision? You all must. Okay, very good. Great. Bless you. I sort of mean that. For all of us who don't have perfect vision, myopia means nearsightedness. Nearsightedness. What that means is you see things in front of you very well. You read the pages in front of you very well. You see the computer screen very well. But when you have to see down the street to see the street signs, that's much harder to read. When you have to see something in a distance, it's much harder to see and much harder to focus on. You can focus on what's right in front of you very well. But what's down the road, you can't focus there. This is what our problem becomes. Because, see, we need to take reality seriously, but what we often do is we can focus on our reality. We can become anxious about it. We can become worried about it. It can begin to overwhelm us like it does the writer of Ecclesiastes. We can become worried about it, and we can make it so that it overwhelms us and we are walking through life with an ongoing sadness and despair. How do we not do that? Well, what we do is as we hold our near reality in front of us as followers of Jesus, we also keep our eyes focused on the reality that is beyond what is happening right at the moment. If you read 2 Corinthians 4, we have a great example of this. Look at 2 Corinthians 4 with me, and you'll see a passage where Paul teaches the Corinthian church to do exactly what we're talking about. 2 Corinthians 4, starting with verse 16, it says, "Therefore we do not lose heart. Though outwardly we are wasting away, inwardly we are being renewed day by day. For our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that outweighs them all. So we fix our eyes not on what is seen, but on what is unseen. For what is seen is temporary, but what is unseen is eternal." Yes, we have to focus on our close reality. We have to be honest about what we are in at the moment, but we also must hold it in tension with the distant reality, the reality that God is at work in our world, and that through Jesus Christ, He has taken all of this mess, all of this brokenness, all of this sin, and He, through His death on the cross and His resurrection, has redeemed all of this. And He has invited all human beings into a relationship with Him so that we can walk through this broken life with Him hand in hand, and we can do the brokenness and the suffering even with God right next to us and right beside us. And we can be a part of Jesus Christ remaking this world, transforming the heart of every single person to become like Him, transforming the world with all of its poverty, all of its racism, all of its hate, all of its polarization, all of its brokenness. Even now, Jesus Christ is at work. As bad as it is, Jesus Christ is at work making all things new, and we can be a part of that. We have to remember, even as we focus on the news, even as we focus on how hard our life may be, even as we focus on the fact that, yes, we will all die and that there is suffering, we must focus that over and beyond that reality, there is a greater reality. a reality of love and grace and forgiveness and hope that overcomes the sin and death that seeks to hold our focus and seeks to hold our attention. We have to look at our current reality with the end in mind. We have to look at our current reality not just with the eyes that see what is in front of us, but what is beyond us in Christ Jesus. So we have to be doing both at the same time. We have to have spiritual bifocals where we can see right in front of us, but also see it at the distance where God is at work. Because friends, if we read the Bible just with what's just in front of us, we would think of the Bible just by reading Ecclesiastes 9 as a very dark and depressing book. But friends, Ecclesiastes 9 is not the whole story. It is reality, but the story goes on. We have to read our lives in the context of the whole story. The story that God loves us, that God sent His Son to die for us, and that we, because He was resurrected from the grave, any single one of us, regardless of what we've done, can step into life with Jesus Christ and walk in a way that changes the world from brokenness to healing and hope. We have to take our story in front of us seriously, but we have to take God's story even more seriously, because God's full story redeems the present story every single day. And that leads us to the next portion of this text that we can learn from this teacher. This next portion, where he sounds a little happier, just a little. Verse 7 of Ecclesiastes 9 says, "Go eat your food with gladness and drink your wine with a joyful heart. For it is now that God favors what you do. Always be clothed in white and always anoint your head with oil. Enjoy life with your wife whom you love all the days of this meaningless life that God has given you under the sun." Have a good time during all this meaningless ugliness. All your meaningless days. For this is your lot in life and in your toilsome labor under the sun. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. For in the grave where you are going, there is neither working nor planting nor knowledge or wisdom. This guy even makes good news sound bad. Enjoy yourself for this whole meaningless existence, he says. Yet, when we look at this from the long view, when we look at it from the view right in front of us, we say, well, you know what? We might as well enjoy ourselves rather than being depressed. It's a better choice. But wait a minute. What if there's more to this story? What if there is something greater? Because you see, what Paul tells the Philippian Christians to do in Philippians 4, he says, "Rejoice in the Lord always." I'll say it again, rejoice. He says, in every circumstance, in every situation, in every bit of our brokenness, find joy. Live with joy. And Paul is not telling us, act happy at every situation. Happiness is something we try to create. Joy is a fruit that we grow. When we decide to become followers of Jesus, we take up the call to grow the fruit of the Spirit. They're in the second one listed. You can look at those. Joy is the second one listed. As a follower of Jesus, we are called to cultivate and grow joy in our lives. And guess what? We're called to grow it in our current reality. In the midst of all the mess, we're called to grow joy. Now, friends, that's a hopefulness that only comes when we fix our eyes on what is unseen. Because too often we look at the brokenness and the misery of life as it is, and we think, there's no joy here. But we are called to cultivate a joy that says, this is not the whole story. As a matter of fact, the story that we believe in, the story of Jesus Christ, actually redeems the story of the present. It actually remakes something that looks like a sad song into a song of joy and worship. It actually takes a song that is the blues and turns it into a song of rejoicing. Friends, we are called to a life of joy. We are called to cultivate joy. C.S. Lewis once wrote that joy is the serious business of heaven. In other words, for any person who's a follower of Jesus, growing joy is the calling of our life. Becoming people of joy in the midst of the chaos is who we are called to be. How are you doing on that? How are we doing on that? Because I got news for you. This teacher in Ecclesiastes, he isn't the only person I've ever met in my life that is this much of a downer. There are folks all around who complaint and negativity have become their native language. And that's simply not what we are called to. We are not called to a life where the words of complaint, the words of negativity, the words of groaning and griping, that's not who we're called to be. We're called to be people who express joy, who live joy in the midst of decline, who live joy in the midst of hard news, who live joy in the midst of difficulty, who live joy in the midst of conflict, who live joy when things at work don't go the way you want, who live joy when things in family are not the way you want, who live joy when the nation isn't necessarily living exactly the way you want. We are called to bring joy into the midst of chaos, into the midst of brokenness. It is the unique gift that Christ followers have to offer. What joy are you bringing? What joy are you bringing to your workplace? What joy are you bringing to your home? What joy are you bringing to the world? Because friends, our joy doesn't come from the momentary experiences that we are living through now. Our joy comes because we've rooted our lives in the soil of Jesus Christ, who remakes all of our lives. Even when it's hard, He gives hope and He gives joy. Even when the circumstances bring us to weep, you can weep as a person with joy. There's a story that's told about the man who has a good friend who can't get happy or joyful about anything. He can't see the good in anything. Maybe you know the kind. Maybe like the Ecclesiastes teacher. So they go off hunting one day. And the friend says to this really morose man, he says, you're gonna be amazed by this new hunting dog I got. This new hunting dog is amazing. So they shoot a couple of doves. The doves fall into the water. And the man sends the dog off. His dog runs out to get the doves in the water. And he runs across the water without sinking, picks up the doves, and runs back. Man looks over at his morose friend and says, "What do you think of that?" The morose friend just shakes his head and says, "Huh, that dog can't swim, can he?" Folks, honestly, most people, when they think of Christians, they think we're way more like that than joy bringers. We're called to be joy bringers. In the midst of life as it is, we're called to be joy bringers. And we should, because we see the end of the story. We have the audacity to believe in the polarized culture that we live in, that God is changing it even now. We have the audacity to believe that God can use the people in this room to change a community, to love a city toward Jesus, to love a city toward loving one another again. We have the audacity to believe that God can do something remarkable and miraculous through the people in this room. That God can use us to be a part of His experience of changing the world in love. Which brings us to the final piece of this scripture I want to point out to you. It's an intriguing piece, starting with verse 13. It says, "I also saw under the sun this example of wisdom that greatly impressed me. There was once a small city with only a few people in it, and a powerful king came against it, surrounded it, and built huge siege works against it. The city by his wisdom, but nobody but wise, and he saved the city by his wisdom, but nobody remembered that poor man. So I said, wisdom is better than strength. But the poor man's wisdom is despised, and his words are no longer heeded. The quiet words of the wise are more to be heeded than the shouts of a ruler of fools. You ever felt like that man in the small city? You ever felt like it was just you, maybe a couple of others, and you were surrounded on all sides? Maybe you're surrounded by hard things that were happening in your lives. Maybe you're surrounded by enemies. Maybe you're just surrounded by your own imagination and your own anxiety. You ever felt surrounded like that? You ever been in a situation there where you wondered, what can one person do? What can one word of goodness do in the midst of all this darkness? Remember another story about one wise man from a very small city who went and taught. And as he taught, some people listened to him. And they hung on to his teachings and they followed him. But many didn't listen. As a matter of fact, many people felt threatened. Many people heard his message of love and his challenge of forgiveness. And they felt threatened. So threatened that the authorities ended up arresting him and having him killed, thinking that the cross would be enough to subdue a revolution. Friends, without the cross, there was no resurrection. And there was a resurrection. And that resurrection of Jesus, that one wise man, has started a revolution that has not stopped. A revolution that says love really does overcome hate. Fear really does succumb to hope. And life really does, under Jesus Christ, have power over death. Friends, I know there are days when it feels hopeless. I know there are days when we feel surrounded. Jesus felt that too. But friends, remember, that is not the whole of the story. The story is bigger, bolder, more beautiful, more perfect. And it is a story that ends with victory, even in the midst of what feels like defeat. We come to this table, the table of victory, that is a table of brokenness.